So large part, it's going to be sort of relatively formal, discussing the mathematics of having some subset lying within your manifold that can also be considered as a manifold itself. And there's kind of two main applications, or if you like, two main motivations for studying this. One is to think about ways of consistently describing objects, such as the domain wall, which, although they're sort of four-dimensional objects, you know, they have a width and an extent in space-time, they're also highly localized. So maybe it's a good approximation to actually describe them, approximately speaking, as zero-width objects. So that's sort of one possible motivation of thinking about this, and that's as a means of describing extended dynamical objects. And the other reason that we want to look at submanifolds is, when we talked about the Einstein action yesterday and looked at the variation of the Ricci tensor, we noticed that the integral of delta r led to a boundary term, which, although it obviously involves delta g, does not involve just straightforwardly delta g. It's actually normal derivatives of delta g. So even if we set delta g equals zero on the edge of our space, that doesn't mean that a normal derivative of delta g will be zero necessarily. So it seems as if, strictly speaking, to use the variational principle properly, we would have to set not just g, but delta g to zero, sorry, the normal derivative of delta g to zero as well on the boundary. And that kind of seems a little bit too restrictive. So that's, if you like, another motivation. And kind of tied in with this, normally, if we wanted to think about sort of stepping, or at least cautiously trying to enter into thinking about gravity in a more quantum sense, so we might want to say, look at taking a path integral with a Euclidean action for gravity in it, then the problem is, if we look at the Einstein-Hilbert action, or the integral of r root g, all vacuum solutions to Einstein gravity would have zero action, which seems a bit off. Normally, physical solutions have a different weighting, so the action kind of gives you a sense of a weighting of a particular process or a particular solution. And so the fact that every vacuum solution has zero weighting just seems a bit wrong. And so maybe if we try sort of poke at this boundary term, we might actually help with that puzzle. So that's kind of the reason why we're going to look at these submanifolds. And so this is known as the Gauss-Kodatsky formalism, or Gauss-Kodatsky. And it's really a means of saying, if we have one manifold living inside another manifold, then we can think of that lower dimensional manifold as sort of being a manifold in its own right. We can take its tangent spaces, we can take its metric connection by sort of taking the metric that sort of it inherits from its parent space-time. And we can sort of do our normal tensor algebra on it. So how does that fit inside the tensor algebra of the parent manifold? And really, that's what Gauss-Kodatsky is about. It's how does the structure of the parent manifold map down into a structure on the submanifold, and you know what gets lost, what gets kept. So that's the sort of idea. So our picture is that we have some manifold sigma, which lives inside some bigger manifold, which is our usual M. So I'm going to say that I'm going to say the dimension of sigma is n, And the dimension of our space-time manifold is capital D. So obviously N is less than D. So that's our setup. Should have drawn something on there before I put it up. So we think we've got sort of little bases living inside sigma, and then I can draw a normal to sigma, which I'm going to call N, in a wonderful bad piece of notation. Maybe I should change the dimension of sigma to little d or something. So the codimension of sigma is basically you take the dimension of the manifold, n of those directions lie within sigma, so the codimension is like the number of normal directions to sigma. So in other words, it's d minus n. So if we're on a point in sigma and we look at the tangent space at that point, the tangent space of the manifold, the idea is there'll be n directions that are parallel to sigma, in other words, coincide with the tangent space of P lying in sigma, and d minus n directions which do not lie in the tangent space of sigma. So I've got this picture that I've got a set of coordinates on sigma. That was the little axes that I was drawing. And I'm labeling those by uppercase Latin letters. So I've got a set of functions that take me from sigma into r to the n. And I pick a normal direction, which means that the vector acting on this function, sigma, vanishes. That's what it means to be normal. And so that's true for every single coordinate function that defines our surface sigma. So we can think of sigma, it's a restriction in the manifold, you can sort of identify it if you like, with a restriction. So we say our coordinates in the manifold are a set of x's dependent on these sigma a's. So it's just like when you take a world line, you would write x mu of t, okay? So that would be a one-dimensional submanifold. So that's our one-dimensional submanifold, and all we're doing is we're saying, well, maybe that our object is extended in space, so there's more than one coordinate associated with it. So in this language, we could write a normal times the derivative of x mu of sigma a. This is like a tangent vector to sigma along one of the coordinate lines, and that's zero. So that's what we mean in a sort of more coordinate or, you know, index notation. So I'm going to just choose my normals I'm using, let me turn that I into a K, otherwise this is going to look confusing. Okay, I'll have to explain this. So I'm going to normalize my normal vectors such that they have length 1. But of course that means if n is time-like, then obviously the length is plus 1. And if n is space-like, then that length is minus 1. And so I'm just going to, for sort of being brief, I'm going to write that as just encoded in terms of minus to the I plus 1. So in other words, I here equals 0 for space-like, and in this case, it equals 1 if it's time-like. So it's not a very good notation, but it's just really to stop sort of me thinking about whether something is plus or minus. I'm just going to write minus to the I, which is either plus or minus 1, dependent on whether the normal is space-like or time-like. It'll sort of become obvious as time goes on. So when Gauss and Kadatsi did this, they defined what they called the first fundamental form. And really, they were trying to sort of think about what were the fundamental objects that were defining or characterizing this submanifold. And the first thing you have to think about if we're doing our sort of normal geometry with distances is how do we get a metric on the submanifold? Intuitively, it's kind of obvious. If we sort of stretch a rubber sheet throughout this room, we would simply say, well, the distance function just is what it is in a three-dimensional sense, but somehow we've got to keep on our rubber sheet. So we take the shortest distance while keeping on the rubber sheet between two points. And so this translates to taking the space-time metric in a local chart and either adding or subtracting NA and B. So if you were dealing with a time-like normal, such as what you might do if you were doing a 3 plus 1 formalism for gravity, a Hamiltonian formalism, then this would be a minus sign in my conventions because you'd have to subtract off the positive dt squared. Yep.
Yeah. Does that mean that the first n is time-like and the second?
No, this is n. This is summing over I. So we're taking pairs ni a ni b.
So is the I that we're summing over the same that's in the exponent?
No, this is just meant to encode whether this is a plus or a minus 1.
So it's not actually minus 1 to the
power. No, it's not. That's why I said it's a bit of a. It's simply because at the, you know, what we're going to be doing is we're going to be decomposing everything with respect to these normals and parallel bases. So it's kind of a shorthand. It's either plus or minus NA and B. So the idea simply is that you take your metric and you kill off every piece of it that's normal to the surface sigma. So that's all that is doing. It's taking, you're still living in the tangent space of M, but you're projecting out any direction that is not parallel to sigma. So it is telling you about this in metric lying within sigma, but it's still living in the tangent space of the higher dimensional manifold. We could also, if we want, think of sigma in its own right as a manifold. So we can also think of what we would call intrinsic quantities to sigma. So although H is parallel to sigma, it's not intrinsic to sigma. It's not like we could just take away M and all the structure of M and be left with H, because H is lying in the tangent space of M. So in that sense, what we want to do, if we think about this dx mu by d sigma A, think about what it does. Dx mu by d sigma A would take, if we just look at the indices, would take a covector lying in the cotangent space of M, and it would give you a covector lying in the cotangent space of sigma. So if we step back to when we did the Lie derivative and talked about maps and manifolds, we can think, therefore, of those x mu of sigma A, that's kind of giving us a map from M into sigma. And so if you remember, when we have maps between manifolds, we can push forward between the tangent spaces and pull back between the cotangent spaces. And I'm wondering if I've done it the other way around in my head. Sorry, let me go. Yeah, that's it. I knew I'd confused it in my head. I think I struggle more with 9 a.m. than you guys do, honestly. So it's so x mu of sigma A is actually the map from sigma into M, apologies, because sigma A are the coordinates lying in sigma, and we are getting coordinates in M from that. So here's our sigma as the manifold. Here's our M as a manifold. Our map in a local chart is given by x mu of sigma A, so that's our pullback. Then our metric is simply the pullback of the space-time metric. So it's kind of the obvious thing. In this case, we don't need to worry about normals because we're automatically projecting out any direction normal to sigma by just taking the contraction with this dx by d sigma a, which lies parallel to the manifold sigma. So that's our metric on the space-time. So what else, what other structure can we think of? So Gauss and Kadatsi call this a second fundamental form. Well, the other thing that we think about, if we sort of think like, you know, again, of a two-dimensional surface embedded in three-dimensional space, it's not just intrinsic distances, but the other thing that we automatically see when we look at the surface is if it isn't straight. So that's the other thing. We don't even have to think about it. We just look at it and you see, well, that thing's not straight, is it? It's got some curvature. Now, that doesn't mean that it's got intrinsic curvature or Ricci curvature, but it does have some sort of curvature because we just intuitively see it. And that's what's encoded in this thing called the second fundamental form. Or its more intuitive label, which is extrinsic curvature. And what extrinsic curvature does is it tells us how our submanifold curves as it's embedded within our higher dimensional manifold M. So we define it, if we're using our index notation, by taking a covariant derivative of our normal and then projecting it down on the manifold. So why do we do that? Well, if I can just sketch some submanifold here, one-dimensional submanifold of the board, and I just sketch a few normals. So those would be the ends. And then I think about just what happens to those normals as I move along the submanifold. Now, from the perspective of my higher dimensional manifold, the blackboard, if I look at this normal here and parallelly propagate it along to this point here, then you can see that there's a difference. So the normal is actually varying along this curve. And that is exactly because the curve itself is curving as I move down the blackboard. So that's what this extrinsic curvature here is encoding. The difference in n, if I look at it, you know, here I'm in flat R squared, so covariant derivative is just partial derivative. Moving from this point to this point, n has changed by this little vector sitting in there. And so I simply take, you know, that vector is two leading order parallel to my submanifold. And so that's kind of the extrinsic curvature there. It's parallel because I've forced my normal to have unit length. I'm sort of not letting the normal, there'd be anything changing in a normal direction. I could also write this in an intrinsic format. By projecting down onto the tangent space of the submanifold. And another way I can write it is, I guess I can do a sort of integration by parts, if you like, and sort of flip the covariant derivative to act on one of these vectors. And this allows me to introduce this new connection, grad n, which is the connection you basically take the connection on the higher dimensional manifold and project out like crazy anything that's normal to sigma, and you end up with a connection on sigma. In this case, this is actually a connection lying within sigma because I projected it down into the tangent space of sigma, but it could, you know, also have a space be in the tangent space of M. Yes, so it is a Levi-Civita connection with respect. So it's sort of every, I think, in fact, I'm not sure if this is part of a tutorial, but it's essentially, it is saying that, you know, if you think about, so it's very easy when you think about vectors, because you can just take the tangent space at a point P and literally just split it in two. You know, you can say, well, this bit's parallel and this bit's perfectly perpendicular. So there it's easy. Obviously, once you've got mixed tensors, then, you know, that changes. But because you can have bits that are part parallel and part perpendicular. But this is the all parallel, if you like, part of the connection. Yep.
Also, when you say that, for example, you have the extrinsic curvature depends on the normal that you choose, would it, for example, if you had like a, suppose you have like a sheet embedded in free space, and you have like a circle on it, then you would have like zero curvature in one direction, but like constant curvature in the other, mm-hmm. like this?
Yeah, but so there's two things you said there. You said one, the extrinsic curvature depends on the normal you use. But you've got a family of normals, right? You've got D minus N of them. And so sure, if I pick one of those normals, I get one particular extrinsic curvature. But the perpendicular plane to my point, you know, to the manifold at some point, is spanned by those normals. And so I've got, you know, a normal for each n, but if I change my basis of n's, I'm just going to do a different combination of the k's. It's not like it's dependent on my choice of n, because anything that happens to my normal off the surface is not relevant. I'm just projecting everything parallel. So if I only had one normal, that k is completely unique. It's only dependent on the choice of normal in the sense that there's a k for every normal. But it doesn't depend on how you choose the normals. It just means you transform between the different k's. So this is kind of what I mean about that projecting everything down. To get the lower dimensional covariant derivative, you take the higher dimensional covariant derivative and just take all of the parallel components. So as an example, which I think also ties in with the question I just had, because I think I picked on the first bit of the question because I knew I was about to address the second. If I look at a submanifold of R cubed, which is the cylinder is defined by x squared plus y squared equals a squared, and it's a subset of R cubed. So R cubed is a flat manifold, so I don't really need to worry about connection unless I want to. My normal is just the radial direction in the xy plane. So the normal here is, as a sort of little three-component vector, it's going to be cos theta, sine theta, 0 in Cartesians. So that's my normal radial vector in Cartesian coordinates. So my h, everything now has length plus 1 because we're in Euclidean space. So I subtract off my normals, Na and B. So in Cartesian basis, H is actually not that pretty. You know, you'd think, you sort of imagine that because you're killing off a direction, there should be zeros magically appearing in the metric, and that's not necessarily true, it depends on your basis. In this case, in Cartesians, I have no connection, but my first fundamental form looks just a little bit messy. I could instead take polar coordinates, in which case my normal, so that's in x, y, z, or my normal would be 1, 0, 0 in r, theta, z coordinates. So in polars, I do get the explicit 0. And it's a sort of more natural coordinate system to use for the cylinder because the cylinder lies at a fixed value of r, so it's a fixed value of one of the coordinates. So you kind of know that that coordinate is telling you about the normal direction, and so for the induced metric, I shouldn't have anything going on in that coordinate direction. So that's kind of the natural thing to do. If I ask what my extrinsic curvature is, then in polars, obviously I do have connection components because I've chosen a curvilinear coordinate system, but they're very easy. I just look at my gamma RAB, and the only non-zero component of that is gamma R theta theta, and that's simply equal to R times delta A theta, delta B theta, and of course R is just A. So if I write that as a matrix, I've just got one component. So that's my K. What would be my intrinsic description of this cylinder? Well, in this case, my intrinsic coordinates I would take to be theta and z. So these are my sigma a's. They're the obvious coordinates to have. I've got a coordinate running up the cylinder, and I've got a coordinate going round the cylinder, and they're orthogonal. So in these coordinates, my intrinsic metric is, I just peel off the corner of the one in polars, and my KAB is A0, 0, 0, 0. So you can see that whichever way, you know, obviously they're the same information, but in one case, this is now just something living on the cylinder, whereas in the other case, I have all the extra pieces. So this is kind of illustrating what I meant when I said one was lying in the tangent space of M and one in the tangent space of sigma. Now, so far, I've only talked about things that happen parallel to sigma, and that's because mostly, that's what we're interested in. But if we have more than one orthogonal direction, then we can also have some additional variation, and this is not parallel to well, there's one component that's parallel to sigma. But if we're trying to think about how we split up our connection into parallel and orthogonal pieces, if we've just got one extra direction, we can kind of always split our metric out into orthogonal direction and parallel piece, kind of like what I did yesterday when I was looking at the domain wall. If we've got more than one orthogonal direction, I can still split into parallel and perpendicular, but my perpendicular space is now two-dimensional. So as I move around my manifold, my normals could kind of move, if you like, in that internal space. Now, this wouldn't really be changing anything about the manifold, but it's like a gauge choice. So I have to kind of think about what happens if my normals change. Now, maybe the normals are changing because I'm being perverse and spinning them round, but maybe the normals are changing because of curvature, because of some real geometrical effect. So that's, if you like, part of the orthogonal piece of the connection. So we define these as normal fundamental forms. And since I've said I've got my normals a unit length, I'm also actually going to choose to extend them geodesically off the surface. The only thing that's left that they can do is have some sort of some rotation, some of the spinning. And to pick out what that is, we say, how does one normal change into a different normal? That's rotation. And the rotation is happening parallel to the surface. So that's kind of why we take this combination. And you can see that it's anti-symmetric in I and J. So you can kind of see why this is like a perpendicular part of the connection. So that's, I mean, that's actually the connection on the normal bundle of sigma, which is just really the bit of the tangent bundle in M that isn't part of the tangent bundle of sigma, if you like, that's cleanly orthogonal to sigma. So this is really, although we have a sort of feeling that there's something real about extrinsic curvature, and we'll see where that comes in a moment, all we've done so far is kind of take first derivatives of things. So in a sense, we're sort of suspicious that maybe extrinsic curvature is somehow part of a connection. So is it really physical? How much of it is physical? And I haven't gone anywhere near taking a projection of the curvature of the manifold, the submanifold sigma and the manifold M. So that's kind of what I want to do now. And you can sort of see that the curvature of sigma is now going to be related to the curvature of the manifold, but there's some pieces missing. And it actually turns out that the pieces missing are those extrinsic curvature pieces. So there is some sort of real physical meaning to it. So this is what's known as the Gauss equation. And it tells us that the Riemann tensor of sigma, to get the Riemann tensor of sigma, we take the Riemann tensor of the manifold, we project everything we can down parallel to sigma, so that's the first part of it. So it inherits some curvature directly from the parallel components of the Riemann tensor, but then there's also a correction which is the square of the extrinsic curvature. So that's what our intrinsic curvature is for a lower dimensional manifold. So I'm just going to run through why that happens, but I'll take codimension one just for simplicity. So we're only going to have a single K. So we're going to use the Riemann identity, which is the commutator of covariant derivatives acting on V, where V is now a vector which lies tangent to sigma, gives us the n-dimensional Riemann tensor. So that's how we're going to find it. And so what we need to do is to express this sigma covariant derivative in terms of the space-time covariant derivative. Mm-hmm. Yes, capitalized indices of a sigma. So at the moment, this is simply saying that this is tangents parallel to sigma, but it's still lying in the tangent, appropriate tangent tensor bundle of M. So here, if I look up to the top as to how to define this lower dimensional covariant derivative, it simply says, well, what I do is I take the higher dimensional covariant derivative and I project every single thing out. So I've got an H for each index here. So that's the first covariant derivative taken care of, but now I've got to project out my second covariant derivative, so this ends up getting a little bit of a long expression. So now I've properly taken something that was the covariant derivative with respect to sigma, and I've written it in terms of quantities relevant to M. So you can see that I'm sort of starting off in good shape, because if I look at the covariant derivative here, take it through to act on the derivative of V, you can see that I'm going to get a commutator of higher dimensional covariant derivatives acting on V, which is going to give me the higher dimensional Riemann tensor. So the first term is good news. So the first term is going to give me my Riemann piece, And then I have to take derivatives of H. Okay, so it's kind of a long expression, but it's not too many steps to go. The first term I'm happy with, because if I'm anti-symmetrizing on C and D, and I can see that this should have been a P and not a Q, then I'm anti-symmetrizing on P and F, which means I use the higher dimensional Riemann identity, and I've got the first term sitting here. So I'm happy with that, and I just need to work with the second term. Now, for the second term, I can see that, for example, this, the covariant derivative of H, well, I have to kind of go back over and look at the expression for H. H is simply equal to G plus or minus NN. So in this case, the covariant derivative hits G and gives me zero, and so all I have is minus to plus or minus nr grad p and g plus ng grad p nr, and the same for the second piece. So I simply get two terms each of derivatives of n. So then I kind of look along and see what have I got, because I've got an awful lot of first fundamental forms sitting out in front of this. Well, this one here, here's got a free normal, nr. That's going to hit that first fundamental form here. So that term's just going to cancel out. You also write the second one here. Okay, what about the second piece? Well, the second piece here, that looks like it might actually still have something, some legs on it. I've got an ng, I've got a derivative of nr. I don't see anything except the v here, so I'll keep this piece for now. I look over here, I've got an nq, that's going to hit that h, so that's going to go. And then finally, here I've got an NF, and that's going to be a normal derivative of V, but V is just sort of a line parallel to sigma, so I don't need to worry about a normal derivative for V. So what that leaves me with is just a term that I said I was happy to see. Because V is meant to lie sort of parallel to sigma. So if I think about extending it off sigma, I can define how I extend it off. You know, essentially what I'm going to do is I'm going to just define it to kind of just parallelly propagate off. So because it's not a vector field really in the whole manifold, I can do that. So it doesn't really give me any information about things happening parallel to sigma. So the first, let's see, where was I at? I've got my Riemann identity, RABCD, VB, and that is equal to this first piece. So I said when I've got antisymmetry on C and D, it gives me antisymmetry on P and F, so that I can use my Riemann identity for. So what have I got there? VG. And then I've got a pile of H's. Now, admittedly, they're different labels, but I can relabel all of those indices to come to the A primed A, B prime B, etc. So I've got my first term now. The second term, if I look here, I've got a derivative of N, covariant derivative of N, but it's contracted with two H's. So this term gives me a KAD. So I get a KAD from that one. And then I've got HCP, an NG, and a grad FVG. And there must be something going on with that F, HFQ. Right, so what is that multiplied by? It's multiplied by a minus to the I. So this second term, let me write the first term in the way I want it. But to get the second term, notice that I've got N dotted with a derivative of V, but N and V are orthogonal, so I can simply reverse the differentiation on that and take pull the V outside and take the derivative of N, getting a minus sign. And then when I've got grad F of NG, I can see that in that case, it's actually being projected parallel to sigma. So I've got a KAD, and then I've got a, why is that Q sitting on its own? Have I misread my own writing? Is it meant to be? HQD. Did I miss a Q there? What have I?
I think this was about
to write QD. Yeah. Thank you. Well, if that's an HQD, I just get HFD there, don't I? So. Then we have to do no. So what have I done wrong? I need to look back. This is a problem with having something from one side to the other. So I've got HPC, an HQD, HAR, HFQ. So HFQ with HQD becomes HFD, but then K. P downstairs, is that what it is? Okay, I'll take your word for it. No. Thank you, that's problem solved. So, if I relabel, I end up with this, and then of course minus C interchanged with D. And if you compare to what I wrote down originally in the Gauss equation, that is indeed, if I pull out the VBs, it's the same expression. Pluses and minuses of abstract index notation. OK, Okay, so what we've managed to do, there are also sort of companion equations, which, you know, if you want to look at the Ricci tensor, they allow us to take the Ricci tensor and take parallel and perpendicular components, but this is kind of what we need for the moment. So what we managed to do is we managed to get a proper description of our submanifold. We've got a knowledge about extrinsic curvature. And actually, if you look, just as an aside, if I look now, go back to my example of the cylinder, and ask what is the Riemann curvature of my cylinder, if I look there at the Gauss equation, the Riemann curvature of the cylinder is the Riemann curvature inherits from the background, which is zero because background's flat r cubed, times this kk term. Now, because k has only one component, that kk term vanishes. So what that means is that the Riemann curvature is zero, intrinsic Riemann curvature. Is zero. And so I think when we first learn about curvature, and then the first time we hear that the cylinder has zero curvature, you kind of think, what, you know, what's going on? This cannot be. But in fact, it's simply because our notion of curvature for the cylinder is the extrinsic curvature, that's our intuitive curvature, but the real intrinsic, implicit curvature is the Riemann or Ricci curvature, and that does indeed vanish. So that's kind of what's going on there, and you see it with Gauss-Kadazy. So just to finish off, I want to return to the action and think about that extra piece that was the normal derivative. Now, if I hold sort of G fixed on the boundary, so I'm now thinking of the boundary delta M, as our submanifold sigma, and I'm going to use this machinery that we've developed. So if I keep my delta G zero, my parallel delta G on sigma zero, then the only thing that can vary in terms of my metric near the boundary is the normal component, because I'm saying that all the parallel parts stay the same. And so this leads me to my delta NA, so I'm going to take N to be space-like just to have a definite sign there. And my delta G so it's simply saying that if I have the boundary metric fixed, everything's going on in the normal. And so what I'm now going to do is to just manipulate those normal derivatives of G, or rather I'm going to think about constructing some intrinsic expression that cancels off the normal derivatives of g. So I'm just going to consider the boundary term just being the trace of the extrinsic curvature. So if I want to find out what delta k is, it's delta of the derivative of n which has two pieces. So now I've used this sort of rewriting of delta n. This term is fine. This is what I've already got, as an, that term already appeared in the normal, you know, when I took the integral of the action, that was already there in the boundary term. So I'm kind of pleased to see that. And now all I've got to do is sort of look at this piece. I see I've already got a delta G inverse in there, so that's kind of a good start. But then I need to kind of work out what happens to these other terms. So I've turned my delta N into a delta G. It's basically what I've done. So when my covariant derivative hits the first piece, I pick up an exterior trace of the exterior derivative. Extrinsic curvature, exterior derivative, dear me. Then I've got sort of derivatives of delta GBC. And then if I take the grad n of n, I've extended my normals geodesically, so I get no further contribution from grad n of n. And so these are the pieces I've got. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to take that combination of normals, na and c, and I'm going to turn that into hac minus delta AC. So let me just check. Do you have a standard model lecture today? Right, okay. Oh dear. Right, so when I do this, you can see that one of those, the delta AC part, takes me to 1/2 NB grad A of delta GAB. So that's the boundary term that I needed to cancel off. So that's that term and that term together. And then when I work the other pieces, I'm claiming that this is what you get. So that's my delta k. Meanwhile, when I take the variation of delta of the square root of the metric, that kind of combines with this piece. And in the end, what I end up with is a total derivative which is just zero because there's no boundary to the boundary of a manifold. And I've got the boundary term that I wanted to cancel off the variation of the Einstein action. So that means that my overall Einstein-Hilbert action is minus 1 over 16 pi g r root g d 4x minus 1 over 8 pi g integral on the boundary of the manifold d 3 of x. And this is the Gibbons-Hawking boundary term. So it's like an extra piece you add to the action to take care of the boundary variation that when you do the variational principle, you get those integrals of normal derivatives of delta g. Yeah, I know, it's delta. Sorry, that was, I was going through quickly because I was trying to just get them down from the notes. I think you have to be careful because, of course, there's no delta H, right? So you kind, you know, there's no variation of G actually sitting on the boundary. So there should be this K, N, B, N, C kind of combines with a G to give you the H. So I think I think it should be root H. I'm just sorry, I'm going to have to go and go back to my notes because I know I was rushing through it at the end. So let me just think about that one to get it precisely correct because I know I'm not going to do it in real time right now. So there's two things. What we're going to do with this first tomorrow is we're going to look at thermodynamics and we're going to actually now try and use an action approach. So we're going to compute actions for black holes. But the other thing that you can do is if you have a dynamical boundary, then you put in, or one way you can look at it is to put in this Gibbons-Hawking boundary term and then this combination of KAB minus a half KHAB turns out to be giving you sort of information about a sort of boundary contribution to your equations of motion, which kind of match with a boundary energy momentum tensor. I better stop because the boards have got to get cleaned.